On dreams. The treatise before this one dealt with the God-sent dreams that belong to the first class, in which we said that the divine sends the visions in sleep by its own direct initiative. In this treatise, we shall show, so far as we can, those dreams that fit the second class. The second class is that, in which our own mind, moved along with the mind of the universe, seems to be possessed and carried by God, so that it becomes capable of anticipating and foreknowing some of the things that are to come. And the first dream proper to this class, of the sort signified, is the vision that appeared upon the ladder set up toward heaven, as follows. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was fixed upon the earth, whose top reached to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And the Lord stood firmly upon it, and said, I am the God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac, do not be afraid. The land on which you are sleeping I will give to you and to your offspring, and your offspring will be as the sand of the earth, and it will spread abroad to the sea and to the south and to the north and to the east. And in you all the tribes of the earth will be blessed, and in your offspring. And behold, I am with you, guarding you on every road on which you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not abandon you until I have done all that I have spoken to you. Genesis 28:12-15. There is a necessary preparation for this vision, and if we determine it precisely, we shall perhaps also be able easily to grasp what is signified by the vision. What, then, is this preparation? And Jacob went out, it says, from the well of the oath and journeyed toward Haran, and he came upon a place, for the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of the place and set it at his head, and he slept in that place. Genesis 28:10-11. And then immediately comes the dream. It is worth raising, then, at the outset, these three questions. First, what is the well of the oath and why was it so named? Second, what is Haran and why, on leaving the well just mentioned, he goes at once to Haran? And third, what is the place and why, when he comes to it, the sun sets and he himself falls asleep? Let us examine the first point at once. To me, then, the well seems to be a symbol of knowledge, for its nature is not superficial but very deep, nor does it lie open in plain view, but loves to hide itself somewhere out of sight, nor is it found easily, but only with much labor and scarcely at all. And this holds not only for the disciplines that contain great and ineffable objects of contemplation, but is observed also in the most trivial of them. Whichever of the crafts you wish to choose, take, not the noblest one for me, but the most obscure of them all, one that perhaps no free person raised in a city would willingly pursue. But that a household slave in the country, wrestling against a difficult and ill-tempered master who compels him to do many unwelcome things, would scarcely take up even unwillingly. For it will be found to be not simple but complex, not to be captured by hunting, hard to find, hard to master, hostile to hesitation and negligence and idleness, but full of zeal and ambition and sweat and care. For this reason those who dug this well, it is said, did not even find water in it, Genesis 26:32, since it has come about that the ends of the disciplines are not merely hard to find, but altogether undiscoverable. For this reason, one person becomes more skilled in grammar, and another more skilled in geometry than another, because the possible extensions and increases cannot be bounded by any limits. For the portion still remaining always exceeds what has already been learned and lies in wait for the learner, so that the one supposed to have touched the limits of a discipline is considered by one judge to be only half complete, while before the tribunal of truth, he seems to be only now beginning. Life is short, someone said, but the craft is long, and its magnitude is best grasped by the one who genuinely immerses himself in it, digging it out as it were like a well. For this reason, it is told that a certain man, dying already gray-haired and extremely old, wept, not out of cowardice from fear of death, but out of longing for learning, as though only now entering upon it, at the very moment he was about to depart from it for the last time. For the soul flowers toward knowledge just when the body's vigor withers with length of time. It is hard, then, before one has reached maturity and full vigor in the more precise apprehension of things, to be tripped up and cut short. This experience is common to all lovers of learning, for whom new discoveries rise and shine upon the old, many born of the soul itself when it is not barren and unfruitful, and many others shown forth unpredictably and spontaneously by nature to those whose minds see sharply. The well of knowledge, then, having no boundary or end, has been shown to be of this sort. Now we must say why it was named an oath. Genesis 26:33. Matters that are in doubt are settled by an oath, and things unstable are made firm, and things unbelieved gain belief. From which it follows that one could affirm nothing so confidently as this, that the kind of wisdom is without boundary and without end. It is a fine thing indeed for one who discourses on these matters, even without swearing, to add his assent. But let one who is not overly ready to agree give his assent only once bound by an oath. Yet let no one shrink from swearing such an oath as this, knowing clearly that he will be inscribed among the pillars of those who keep their oaths well. Enough, then, on these points. It would follow next to consider why, of the four wells dug by Abraham and Isaac and their households, Genesis 21:25, 26, 19-23, the fourth and last was called oath. Might it not, then, be that this wishes to indicate, by way of undertones, that since the universe as a whole is composed of four elements, and we ourselves likewise are shaped from an equal number, from which, having been molded, we were formed into human shape, three of these are by nature in some way apprehensible, while the fourth is beyond the grasp of every judge. In the universe, then, it happens that earth and water and air and heaven are the four elements in all. And of these, while the other three may be hard to discover, they have not been assigned altogether to the lot of the undiscoverable. For indeed we grasp of earth that it is a heavy body, indissoluble and solid, divided into mountains and level plains, and separated by rivers and sea, so that some parts become islands and others form continents, and that part of it has thin soil and part deep soil, and part is rough and harsh and stony and altogether barren, while part is smooth and soft and most fertile, and countless other things besides these we apprehend. And again of water, that it has many things in common with what has been said of earth, and other things peculiar to itself. For part of it is sweet, part briny, part marked by other distinguishing qualities. And part is drinkable, part not drinkable, and neither quality belongs to all waters, but where one quality is present, the other is not. And where the one is absent, the other is certainly present. And part is cold, and part is by nature warm, for there are countless springs in many places that pour out boiling water, not only on land but also in the sea. Indeed, streams have even been observed sending up boiling water in the midst of the open sea, streams that the vast surrounding expanse of the seas, though flooding over them from age to age, has not been able to quench, nor even to cool down to any degree. And again, that air has a nature that yields, giving way in exchange with bodies, being the instrument of life, of breathing, of sight, of hearing, and of the other senses, admitting states of density and rarity, of motion and of rest, turning and changing in every kind of alteration and transformation, generating winters and summers and the seasons of autumn and spring, from which the cycle of the year comes by nature to its completion. Of all these things, then, we have perception, but heaven has a nature beyond our grasp, having sent us no clear mark of itself. For what could we say of it? That it is frozen crystal, as some have claimed, or that it is the purest fire? Or that it is a fifth, circularly moving body, sharing in none of the four elements? What again of the fixed and outermost sphere? Does it have depth extending upward, or is it itself only a surface devoid of depth, resembling flat figures? What again of the stars? Are they masses of earth full of fire? For some have said they are ravines and glens and glowing lumps of ore, deserving themselves of prison and mill, in which such things are used for the punishment of the impious. Or are they, as someone has said, a continuous and dense harmony, indissoluble compressions of ether? Are they ensouled and possessed of mind, or without share in mind and soul? Do they have motions that are voluntary, or only motions under compulsion? What again of the moon? Does it bring a genuine light of its own, or a borrowed one kindled by the rays of the sun? Or is it, in itself, neither of these separately, but rather a blend of both, as it were of its own fire and another's? For all these matters, and others of this kind, belonging to the noblest and fourth of the bodies in the universe, heaven, are obscure and beyond grasp, resting upon conjectures and guesses, not upon any firm account of the truth. So that even if someone were bold enough to swear an oath, that no mortal has ever yet been able to grasp any of these things clearly, the oath would hold true. For this reason, the fourth and dry well was named oath, being the inquiry into the fourth of the elements in the universe, an inquiry without end and altogether hard to find, the inquiry into heaven. Let us now see in what way the fourth element within ourselves too is by nature exceptionally, and in a special sense beyond our grasp. Now the four highest things that concern us are body, sense perception, reason, and mind. And of these, three are not obscure in every respect, but contain within themselves certain evidences that allow them to be apprehended. And what do I mean by this? That we know the body is extended in three directions and moves in six ways. It has three dimensions, length, depth, and breadth, and twice that many motions, upward, downward, to the right, to the left, forward, and backward. We are also not ignorant that it is a vessel for the soul, but that it also grows to maturity, wastes away, grows old, dies, and dissolves. This we know clearly. Nor with regard to sense perception have we become entirely dull and blind, but we can say that it divides into five, and that each has its own organs fashioned by nature: eyes for sight, ears for hearing, nostrils for smell, and the rest fitted to their proper objects. And that they are messengers of the mind, reporting colors, shapes, sounds, the particular qualities of scents and flavors, and in short bodies and whatever qualities are in them. And that they are the soul's bodyguards, disclosing whatever they see or hear, and, foreseeing and guarding against anything harmful that approaches from outside, keep it from stealing in unnoticed and becoming a cause of irreparable harm to their mistress. Nor does sound altogether escape our judgment. Rather, we know that one sound is high, another low, one melodious and harmonious, another discordant and quite unmusical, and again one greater, another lesser. And they differ in countless other ways too, in kind, in color, in intervals, in conjunct and disjunct tunings, in the concords of the fourth, the fifth, and the octave. And of articulate speech too, which of all living creatures man alone has been allotted, there are things we know, for instance, that it is sent up from the mind, that it is articulated in the mouth, that the tongue, striking with the tension of the voice, stamps it as articulate and makes it speech, not merely bare, inert, and shapeless sound, and that it holds the rank of herald or interpreter before the mind that dictates it. Is, then, the fourth of the things within us, the mind that governs, also comprehensible? Surely not. For what do we suppose it to be in its essence? Breath, or blood, or body altogether. But no, we must call it incorporeal, or a limit, or a form, or a number, or a continuity, or a harmony, or any other of the things that exist. When it is born, does it come in at once from outside, or is our inward warm nature tempered by the surrounding air, as iron heated by the smith is tempered by cold water into its hardest state? For this reason, it is thought to be called soul, psyche, from cooling psyxis. And again, at death, is it extinguished and destroyed along with the body, or does it survive for a very long time, or is it altogether imperishable? And where has the mind taken up its lodging? Has it been allotted a house? Some have consecrated to it the Acropolis within us, the head, around which the senses too keep watch, thinking it likely that its bodyguards station themselves nearby, as with a great king. Others, holding that it is enshrined beneath the heart, dispute the point. In any case, the fourth thing is always incomprehensible. Heaven and the cosmos, set apart from the nature of air, earth, and water, and mind and man, set apart from body, sense perception, and speech its interpreter. Perhaps it is for this reason that the fourth year is declared holy and praiseworthy in the sacred records, Lev. 1924. For what is holy among created things is heaven in the cosmos, around which the imperishable and long-lived natures revolve, and in man it is the mind, being a fragment divine, most of all according to Moses, who says, "He breathed into his face the breath of life, and man became a living soul." Gen 2, 7. And it seems to me not without purpose that each is called praiseworthy as well. For these are the things capable of proclaiming, as in a tragic chorus, the praises, hymns, and blessings of the Father who begot them, heaven and mind. For man has been allotted a privilege beyond the other creatures, to serve the one who is, while heaven forever sings, producing through the motions of the beings within it a harmony of all music. And if it happened that its sound reached our hearing, uncontrollable loves and raging longings and unceasing, maddening frenzies would arise. So that, sustained no longer as mortals by food and drink through the throat, we would be nourished, like those about to be made immortal, through the ears, by songs divine of perfect music. Of these, Moses is said to have been a hearer, when, having become incorporeal, For 40 days and an equal number of nights, he touched neither bread nor water at all, Exod. 24:18. Heaven, then, the archetypal instrument of music, seems to have been tuned to the height of perfection for no other reason than that the hymns sung in honor of the Father of all might be accompanied musically. And indeed we hear that virtue, called Lee, at the birth of her fourth son could bear no more, but checked, or was checked in her childbearing. For she found, I think, that all generation from her was dry and barren once she had brought Judah, confession, the perfect fruit, into flower. And it makes no difference whether one says that she ceased bearing, Gen 29:35, or that at the fourth well the servants found no water, Gen 26:32, since by both symbols alike it is shown that all things thirst for God, by whom the generation and nourishment of created things are watered. Now small-minded citizens of petty towns will perhaps suppose that the lawgiver's lengthy account concerns nothing more than the digging of wells. But those enrolled in the greater fatherland, this cosmos, being of more perfect understanding, will know clearly that the inquiry, for those who are given to seeing and to the contemplation of beauty, concerns not wells but the four parts of the universe, earth, water, air, and heaven. Going through each of these with utmost care of thought, in three of them they found things comprehensible, and they gave three names to what they found: injustice, enmity, and wide space. Gen 26:20, 21, 22. But in the fourth, heaven, nothing at all, as we showed a little earlier. For the fourth well is found to be without water, dry, and is called an oath for the reason stated. Let us pursue what follows by inquiring who Haran is, and why he, having gone out from the well, comes to her, Gen 28:10. Haran, then, as it appears to me, is a kind of mother city of the senses, for it is interpreted sometimes as dugout, sometimes as holes, both names disclosing one and the same thing. For our body has, in a certain manner, been hollowed out into the organs of the senses, and each of the organs has become a kind of hole for each sense, in which it is its nature to lodge. So then, whenever someone puts out from the well called the oath, as from a harbor, he necessarily arrives at once at Haran. For one setting out on a journey away from the best and boundlessly vast region of knowledge is inevitably received by the senses, without any guides. For our soul is often moved by itself, having stripped off the whole bodily mass and fled the crowd of the senses, and often too clothed with these once more. Its naked motion, then, has been allotted the things comprehensible by thought alone, while its motion in company with the body has been allotted the things perceptible by sense. If, then, someone is altogether unable to commune by thought alone, he finds sense perception as a second refuge, and whoever fails of the objects of thought is at once drawn down to the objects of sense. For the second voyage is always toward sense perception, for those who have not been able to sail well toward the governing mind. It is good, even once one has arrived here, not to grow old and settle permanently, but, living as in a foreign land like a resident alien, always to seek removal and return to one's native soil. For Laban, knowing nothing at all, no form, no kind, no idea, no concept, none of the things apprehended by thought alone, but hanging upon what is visible, whatever comes to sight and hearing and the kindred faculties, has been judged worthy of Haran as his fatherland, which the virtue-loving Jacob inhabits for a short time as a stranger, remembering his return home. At any rate, the mother, endurance that is Rebecca, says to him, "Rise up and flee to Laban, my brother, to Haran, and dwell with him some days." Gen 27:43-44. Do you understand, then, that the one in training does not endure to spend his life dwelling in the region of the senses, but only a few days and a short time, because of the necessities of the body bound to him, while a long age and life is stored up for him in the intelligible city? For this reason, it seems to me that his grandfather in knowledge as well, Abraham by name, did not endure to linger long in Haran. For it is said that Abraham was 75 years old when he went out from Haran. Gen 12:4, even though his father Terah, whose name is interpreted as scouting of scent, lived there until his death, having spent his life there. It is expressly declared in the sacred records that Terah died in Haran. Gen 11:32. For he was a scout of virtue, not a citizen, and made use of sense but not of the enjoyment of foods, not yet being able to be filled with wisdom, nor even to taste it, but only to catch its scent. For just as hunting dogs, we are told, sharpened by nature with an especially keen sense of smell, track and find even the most distant carcasses of wild beasts by scent. In the same way, the lover of learning tracks the sweet breeze given off by justice and the rest of virtue, and longs to encounter those very sources from which is given off this most admirable brightness. But being unable, he carries his head about idle and futile, merely catching the scent of nobility of character and the most sacred savor of its food, for he does not deny that he is greedy for knowledge and wisdom. Blessed, then, are those to whom it has been given to enjoy the love charms of wisdom and to feast upon her contemplations and doctrines, and who, even once well feasted, still thirst, carried onward by an insatiable and unquenchable longing for knowledge. Second place, however, will be won by those who could not enjoy the sacred table itself but caught the savor of it, wafted into their own souls. For these will be revived by the breezes of virtue, just as those weakened by illness, unable to take food, are brought sense for their recovery, the saving remedies against fainting that physicians' assistants prepare in advance. It is said that Terah, having left the land of Chaldea, moved his household to Haran, bringing with him his son Abraham and the other members of his family. Not so that we might learn, as from a writer of history, that certain people once migrated, leaving their ancestral land and settling in a foreign one as though it were their homeland, but so that a lesson most useful for life and fitting for a human being should not go unheeded. What is this lesson? The Chaldeans study astronomy, while the citizens of Haran busy themselves with the region of the senses. The sacred word therefore says to the one who spies out the workings of nature, "Why do you inquire about the sun, whether it is a foot wide, whether it is larger than the whole earth, whether it is many times its size? Why do you ask about the illuminations of the moon, whether it has a borrowed light or uses only its own? Why do you ask about the nature of the other stars, or their revolutions, or their sympathy with one another and with things on earth? Why, while walking on the earth, do you leap beyond the clouds? Why do you claim to be able to grasp the things in the upper air while your feet are rooted to dry land? Why do you dare to draw conclusions about things that admit of no evidence? Why do you meddle with matters aloft that are not your concern? Why do you stretch the ingenuity you display in your studies all the way to heaven? Why do you practice astronomy, babbling about the sky? Do not, my friend, examine what is above you and beyond you, but consider what is near at hand, rather, examine yourself without flattery. How then will you examine yourself? Go in mind to Haran, the excavated place, the pits and hollows of the body, and inspect your eyes, ears, nostrils, and all the other organs of sense. And pursue the philosophy most necessary and most fitting for a human being, asking, what is sight, what is hearing, what is taste, what is smell, what is touch, and what, in general, is sensation? And then ask what it is to see and how you see, what it is to hear and how you hear, what it is to smell or taste or touch, and how each of these processes ordinarily comes about. But before examining one's own household thoroughly, is it not the height of madness to investigate that of the universe? And I am not yet giving you a greater command than this, to see your own soul and your mind, on which you pride yourself so greatly, for you will never be able to comprehend it. Go up now into heaven and boast about the things there, though you have not yet been able to know, as the poet's verse says, what good and evil are wrought within your own halls. Bring the spy back down from heaven, draw him away from that inquiry, and know yourself. Then work diligently at this too, so that you may obtain a share of human happiness. In this way the Hebrews name him Terah, and the Greeks name him Socrates. For they say that Socrates too grew old in the most exacting inquiry into the precept know yourself, philosophizing about nothing beyond what concerned himself. But he was a man, whereas Terah is the very principle set forth concerning self-knowledge, like a most flourishing tree, so that the lovers of virtue might readily pluck from it the fruit that shapes character and be filled with saving and most pleasant nourishment. Such, then, are our spies of understanding. But the natures of those who compete and contend for it are more perfect still. For these, having thoroughly mastered the whole account concerning the senses, see fit to proceed to some further and greater object of contemplation, leaving behind the hollows of sensation, which are named Haran. Among these is Abraham, who attained advances and improvements toward the reception of the highest knowledge. For when he knew most, that was when he most despaired of himself, so that he might come to exact knowledge of the one who truly is. And this is naturally so. Whoever comprehends himself thoroughly has thoroughly despaired of himself, having clearly grasped in advance the nothingness in every respect of what is created. And whoever has despaired of himself comes to know the one who is. We have now shown what Haran is, and why the one who leaves the well of the oath comes to it. We must next consider the third and following point: what is the place he encounters? For it is said, he encountered a place, Jinn 28:11. Place is conceived in three ways: first, as a region filled by a body; second, in a different sense, as the divine word, which God himself has filled wholly and entirely with incorporeal powers. For it says, I saw the place where the God of Israel stood, Exod. 24:10, the place, and that place alone, where he permitted sacred rites to be performed, forbidding them elsewhere. For it has been ordained to go up to the place that the Lord God shall choose, and there to sacrifice the whole burnt offerings and the peace offerings, and to bring up the other unblemished sacrifices, Deut. 12:5ff. In a third sense, God himself is called place, because he encompasses all things while being encompassed by nothing whatsoever, because he is the refuge of all things, and because he is his own region, having made room for himself and being contained by himself alone. I, then, am not a place, but am in a place, and so is each of the things that exist. For what is contained differs from what contains it, whereas the divine, being contained by nothing, is of necessity itself its own place. This is confirmed for me by the oracle given concerning Abraham. He came to the place that God had told him of, and lifting up his eyes, he saw the place from a distance, Gen 22:3-4. Tell me, did the one who had already come to the place see it from a distance? But perhaps there is here an ambiguity between two distinct things, of which the one is the divine word, and the other is the God who is prior to the word. The one, then, who has been guided by wisdom as a stranger arrives at the former place, having found the divine word as the head and end of his contentment. And having come to be in that word, he does not yet succeed in coming to God as he is in his being, but sees him from a distance. Or rather, he is not even capable of beholding that one even from afar, but sees only this: that God is far removed from all that has come to be, and that the comprehension of him is settled at the furthest remove from every human understanding. Yet perhaps, in this allegory, he has not now taken place to stand for the cause at all, but what is meant is rather this: he came to the place, and lifting up his eyes he saw it, that very place to which he had come, as being far from the unnameable, ineffable God who is beyond comprehension under every form. With this established beforehand, when the one in training comes to Haran, that is, to sense perception, he encounters a place. Gen 28:11, neither the place filled by a mortal body, for all the earthborn share in this, having filled a region and occupying some place, as of necessity, nor the third and best place, of which one could scarcely gain a notion by spending one's time at the well that was called the Oath, where the self-taught race, Isaac, dwells. Never departing from faith in God and trust in what is unseen, but rather he encounters the middle, the divine word, who guides toward what is best and teaches whatever is fitting for the occasion. For God, not deeming it fitting to come himself into sense perception, sends his own words to help those who love virtue. And these heal and cure the sicknesses of the soul, setting forth sacred exhortations like unshakable laws, calling souls to their exercises, and, like trainers, implanting in them strength and power and an unconquerable vigor. Fittingly, then, the one who has come to sense perception encounters no longer God himself, but the word of God, just as his grandfather in wisdom, Abraham, did. For it is said, the Lord departed, when he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Gen 18:33. From which it is gathered that to meet with such sacred words is to meet words from which the God who is prior to all things has withdrawn, no longer extending his own manifestations directly from himself, but those that come from the powers that follow after him. It is most extraordinary that the text does not say he came to the place, but that he encountered a place. For to come is voluntary, but to encounter is often involuntary, so that the divine word, appearing suddenly, might offer to the desolate soul an unexpected joy greater than hope, being about to journey with it as its companion. For Moses too leads the people out to the meeting with God, Exod. 19, 17, knowing well that God comes invisibly to meet souls that long for him. He then gives the reason why he encountered the place. For the sunset, it says Gen 28, 11, not this visible sun, but the most radiant and most brilliant light of the invisible and greatest God. Whenever this light shines upon the mind, the lesser lights of reasoning set, and still more, all the places of sense perception are cast into shadow. But whenever it withdraws elsewhere, everything at once rises and comes forth. Do not be surprised that the sun, by the rules of allegory, is likened to the father and ruler of all things. For nothing is truly like God, but among things reckoned so by opinion, there are only two, the invisible and the visible. The invisible being the soul, the visible being the sun. He has shown the soul's likeness to God elsewhere, where he says, God made man, according to the image of God he made him, Gen 1:27, and again in the law laid down against murderers. Whoever sheds a man's blood, his own blood shall be shed in return, because I made man in the image of God, Gen 9:6. The likeness of the sun, however, he has indicated through symbols. It is easy to perceive this in another way as well, by inference. First, because God is light, for it is sung in the hymns, the Lord is my light and my salvation, P.S. 27:1, and not only light, but the archetype of every other light, or rather older and higher than every archetype, holding the relation of a pattern to it. For the pattern was his most complete word light, for God said, let there be light, Gen 1:3, while he himself is like none of the things that have come to be. Next, just as the sun distinguishes day from night, so Moses says God built a partition wall between light and darkness. For God separated the light from the darkness. Gen 1:4. And just as the sun, once it has risen, reveals what was hidden among bodies, so also God, having generated all things, not only brought them into visibility, but made what previously did not exist, being not merely a craftsman but a founder in his own right. In the sacred word, understood by way of its deeper meanings, the sun is spoken of in many senses. In one sense, it is the human mind, which those build up like a city and construct who are compelled to serve what is generated rather than the unbegot, those of whom it is said. They built fortified cities for Pharaoh, Pithom, the word to which persuasion belongs, and Rameses, perception, by which the soul is eaten away as though by moths, for Seismos is interpreted as of a moth. And on, the mind, which he named City of the Sun, Exod. 1:11, since, like the sun, it has assumed leadership over our whole mass and extends its own powers like rays into the whole. Everyone who has taken up the citizenship of the body claims as father-in-law the priest and attendant of the mind, whose name is Joseph. For it says, he gave him Asenath, daughter of Pentefer's priest of Heliopolis, as wife, Gen 41:45. In a second sense, he calls perception, symbolically, sun, since all perceptible things are made visible by the intellect. Of this he has spoken thus. The sun rose upon him when the form of God had passed by, Gen 32:31. For indeed, when we are no longer able to dwell together with the most sacred forms and with the bodiless images of the one who is, but turn aside and pass elsewhere, we make use of that other light, the light of perception, which differs from sound reason not at all. One might simply say, from darkness. This light, once risen, arouses sight and hearing, and further taste and smell and touch as though they were sleeping, but turns prudence and justice and knowledge and wisdom, though wide awake, into sleep. For this reason, the sacred word says that no one can be pure before evening, Lev. 11:24 and elsewhere, since the intellect is still overpowered by the movements that come through perception, as by poisons. And he lays down for the priests too, as at once a law and a maxim from which there is no escape, when he says, he shall not eat of the holy things unless he has washed his body with water, and the sun sets, and he becomes clean. Lev. 22:6-7. For through these words, he shows most clearly that no one is altogether pure enough to make use of the holy and sacred rites, so long as he still values the perceptible splendors of mortal life. But if someone does not accept these, he is, in consequence, illumined by the light of prudence, by which he will be able to wash and cleanse away the stains of empty opinions. Or do you not see that the sun itself, both rising and setting, produces opposite effects? For whenever it rises, all things on earth are lit up all around, while the things in heaven are hidden. But when it sets, conversely, the stars appear, while the things around the earth are cast into shadow. In the same way within us too. Whenever the light of the senses rises like a sun, it happens that the truly Olympian and heavenly sciences are hidden. But whenever it goes down toward its setting, the most star-like and most divine rays of the virtues shine forth, at which time the pure mind comes to be hidden by nothing perceptible. In the third sense, he calls the divine word, sun, the archetype, as was said before, of the sun that circles through heaven, of which it is said. The sun went out over the earth, and Lot entered into Zoar, and the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire. Gen 19:23-24. For the word of God, whenever it arrives at our earthly constitution, comes to the aid and assistance of those who are akin to virtue and inclined toward it, so as to provide them with refuge and complete deliverance, but sends upon their adversaries ruin and incurable destruction. In a fourth sense, the sun, spoken of, is the ruler of the universe himself, as I have already said, through whom the sins that seem to be hidden but are past healing are uncovered. For all things are known to God just as they are possible for him. This is why he leads to the sun those who, their souls' proper tensions collapsed, consort licentiously and rather lustfully with the daughters of the mind, the senses, like harlots and prostitutes, in order that they may be exposed. For he says, and the people encamped in Shittim interpreted thorns, a symbol of the passions that goad and wound the soul. And it was profaned, he says, in that it fornicated with the daughters of Moab. These are the senses called daughters of the mind, for Moab is interpreted from the father, and he adds, take all the leaders of the people and make an example of them to the Lord before the sun, and the wrath of the Lord shall turn away from Israel. Num 25:1-4. For not only did he wish the hidden wrongs to become manifest, and so shone the sun's rays upon them, but he also called the father of the universe, sun, by way of symbol, he to whom all things are plainly visible, even those that are carried out invisibly in the recesses of the mind. And when these are made manifest, he says, the one who alone is gracious will be gracious. Why? Because, if the intellect, supposing it will escape the notice of the divine while doing wrong, as though God were not able to see everything, goes astray in secret and in hidden recesses, and afterward, whether of itself or guided by another, comes to understand that it is impossible for anything to be unknown to God, and unfolds itself and all its deeds, and, bringing them out into the open, displays them as though into the sunlight before the overseer of the universe, saying that it repents of the things it formerly, in a thankless disposition, wrongly supposed, for nothing is unknown to him, but all things, not only what has been done but even what is hoped for, are known and clear to him in great abundance. Then it has been cleansed and benefited, and has made gentle the reproof set over it as chastiser, using a just anger, if indeed repentance, being a younger brother, is accepted by him next after not sinning at all. He is also seen elsewhere applying sun symbolically to the cause, as in the law written concerning those who lend on pledges. Consider the law. If you take as a pledge the garment of your neighbor, you shall restore it to him before the sun sets. For this is his only covering, this is the garment of his shame. In what shall he sleep? If then he cries out to me, I will listen to him, for I am compassionate. Exod 22:26-27. Is it not fitting to remind, if not reproach, those who suppose that the lawgiver was so earnestly concerned about a cloak? What are you saying, my good sirs? Does the founder and ruler of the universe call himself compassionate over so trivial a matter as a garment not returned by a lender to a debtor? Such are the suppositions of those who have not once beheld the greatness of the virtue of the God who is great in all things, and who attribute human pettiness, contrary to what is right and just, to the unbegotten and incorruptible nature, full of blessedness and happiness. For what wrong do lenders do in holding pledges among themselves until they recover what is their own? The debtors are poor, someone will perhaps say, and deserve pity. Then would it not have been better to write a law by which they raise funds for them by subscription, rather than either declaring them debtors or forbidding lending on pledges? But the one who permits it could not reasonably be displeased, as though at the impious, with those who do not give back before the time what they received. But someone who has come, so to speak, to the utmost limits of poverty, wearing one single rag and brings in new lenders, has abandoned the pity that pours out on every side from those who see such misfortunes befalling people at home, at temples, in the marketplace, everywhere. But as things stand, even the one covering he had for shame, with which he screened over what nature keeps unspoken, this he brings and holds out. A pledge for what, tell me? For some other, better garment. For no one lacks necessary food, so long as springs gush forth, rivers flood in their season, and the earth yields its yearly crops. Is the lender then so deeply wealthy, or so utterly cruel, that he is willing to contract with someone for 4 drachmas, or perhaps even less, and to lend to one so destitute rather than give outright, or to take as a pledge the one garment that was his, which under another name might fairly be called stripping him? For it is the custom of clothes strippers, in undressing people, to take away their garments and expose them naked, those who had them. Why did he take care that no one should sleep unclothed at night, but no longer show equal concern that one awake by day should be shamefully naked? Is it not that at night and in darkness all things are hidden, so that one feels less shame or none at all, while by day and in light they are uncovered, so that one is compelled to blush the more? And why did he command not to give the garment but to give it back? For giving back applies to what belongs to another, and pledges belong more to the lenders than to the borrowers. But do you not consider this, that he did not command the debtor, once he had received the garment for his night's rest, to rise by day and remove it and carry it back to the lender? And yet even the slowest reader, given the peculiar character of the wording, would be led to grasp something beyond the bare letter, for the ordinance resembles a definition more than an exhortation. Someone exhorting would have said, "The cloak taken in pledge, if it is the debtor's only garment, return before evening, so that he may have it to wrap himself in at night," but instead the lawgiver defines it as it actually stands. "For this is his only covering, this is the garment of his shame, in what shall he sleep?" Exod 22:27. This much and matters like it, let us say to the sophists of the literal exercise, who arch their eyebrows so severely. But let us ourselves, following the laws of allegory, say what is fitting about these things. We say, then, that the garment is a symbol of reason. For just as clothing wards off the harms that cold and heat are wont to inflict on the body, and screens the parts nature keeps hidden, and is an ornament fitted to the body, so too. In a similar way, reason was given to man by God as the most beautiful of gifts. First, as a weapon of defense against those who would rise up against him. For just as nature has armed each of the other animals with defenses of its own, by which it beats off those who attempt to wrong it, so to man too God has given reason as the greatest bulwark and unbreakable guard, wrapped in which as in a suit of armor he will have a companion and champion most his own and closest to him. And using this as his advocate in the front line, he will be able to repel the harms brought against him by his enemies. Second, reason is most necessary as a covering against shame and reproach. For reason is skilled at concealing and shading over the sins of human beings, and third, as an ornament for the whole of life. For it is reason that makes each thing, and all things, better, and leads them toward what is superior. But there are certain plagues and banes among human beings, who take reason itself in pledge, stripping it from those who possess it, and, when they ought to help it grow, instead cut off the whole of it, like men who ravage the territory of their enemies and set about destroying the grain and the rest of the crop, which, if left standing, would have been of great benefit to those who used it. So there are some who wage an implacable, undeclared war on rational nature, cropping its shoots to the very skin and crushing its first growths, rendering it, so to speak, barren and sterile of good pursuits. For when a soul is sometimes rushing toward education with unrestrained impulse, struck by love of the doctrines of philosophy, these men, in envy and malice, fear that it will breathe mightily, rise to the greatest heights, and flood, like a torrent, their own petty word-splitting and their plausible inventions against the truth. And so they divert its current elsewhere, into their own base contrivances, channeling it off toward vulgar and illiberal crafts. Often, too, having aborted and choked it, they leave its natural greatness idle, like wicked guardians who leave a deep-soiled, fertile land, belonging to orphan children, barren, and, most pitiless of all men, they feel no shame in stripping from a human being his only garment, reason. "For this," it says, is his only covering Exod 22:27. What else is there besides reason? For just as neighing is proper to the horse, and barking to the dog, and lowing to the ox, and roaring to the lion, so speaking reason itself is proper to man. This is the bulwark, the covering, the panoply, the wall of that creature most beloved of God, man, who alone of all creatures has reaped it as his own. Hence it goes on to say, this garment alone is the covering of his shame, Exod 22:27. For who else so shades over and conceals the reproaches and shames of life as reason does? Ignorance is a shame kindred to a rational nature, but education is a sister of reason, its own proper ornament. In what, then, shall he sleep? That is, in what shall a man find rest and repose, except in reason? For reason lightens the burden of our most heavily fated race. Just as those pressed down by griefs or fears or other evils have often been healed by the kindness, familiarity, and tact of friends. So, not often, but always reason alone, the averter of evil, drives off the heaviest weight of all. The weight laid on us both by the necessities of this body bound to us and by the unforeseen mishaps that assail us from without. For reason is our friend, our acquaintance, our intimate, our companion, bound to us, or rather fitted and united to us, by some indissoluble and invisible glue of nature. For this reason it foretells what will be to our advantage, and should something unwanted occur, it is present unbidden to help, bringing not merely the one benefit that an idle advisor or a passive ally provides, but both at once. For it has not practiced a half-finished power, but one whole and complete in all its parts. And if it should fail in the attempt, in the things it has in mind or is carrying out in deed, it arrives at a third resource, consolation. For reason is a remedy, as for wounds, and a saving medicine for the passions of the soul, and the lawgiver says it must be returned before the sun goes down, Exod 22:26. That is, before the most radiant beams of the greatest and most manifest God set, which out of mercy for our race, he sends down from heaven into the human mind. For while that most godlike and bodiless light remains in the soul, we shall return the reason we had taken in pledge, as one returns a garment, so that the one who receives it may cover the shame of his life with what is properly man's own possession, enjoy the divine gift, and rest in peace, in the presence of such a counselor and shield-bearer, who will never abandon the post assigned to him. So then, while God still makes the sacred light shine upon you, hasten to return the pledge to its owner by day. For once it sets, you will have, like all Egypt, Exod 10:21, a darkness you can feel, and struck with blindness and ignorance, you will be stripped of all you thought you controlled, by him who sees Israel, whom you were holding as a pledge though he is by nature free, enslaving him by force. We have drawn out this long course for no other reason than to teach that the mind in training, moving unevenly between prosperity and its opposite, and in a sense continually rising and descending, when it prospers and is lifted to the heights, is illumined by the archetypal, bodiless rays of the rational spring of the God who brings all to fulfillment. But when it descends and looks downward, it is illumined by the images of those rays, the immortal words, which are customarily called angels. That is why it now says, he came upon a place, for the sun had set, Gen 28:11. For when the rays of God abandon the soul, the rays through which the clearest apprehensions of things come about, a second and weaker light rises, the light of words, no longer of realities, just as it happens in this world too. For the moon, taking second place after the sun, sends a dimmer light down to the earth once the sun has set. Indeed, to meet with a place or a word. For those unable to see the God who exists before place and word is a most sufficient gift, because they were not left utterly without light in their souls. Rather, once that unmixed light set from them, they harvested a mixed light instead. For the sons of Israel had light in all the places where they dwelt. It says in the Exodus narrative, 10:23, so that night and darkness were forever banished from among them. Unlike those whose souls' eyes are maimed even before their bodies are, who live without ever knowing the rays of virtue. Some, however, supposing that what is here called the sun symbolically means sense perception and mind, the standards of judgment reckoned as ours, and that the place means the divine word, have understood it this way. the man in training met the divine word once the mortal and human light had set. For as long as the mind supposes that sense perception firmly apprehends both intelligible and sensible things, and roams on high, the divine word stands far off. But once each, mind and sense alike, has confessed its own weakness, and in a manner of speaking has set like the sun and hidden itself, then right reason, the guardian ever seated beside the soul in training, comes forward at once in welcome to a soul that has despaired of itself and waits, unseen, for the one who visits it from without. It says then, next, that he took some of the stones of the place and put them at his head and slept in that place. Gen 28:11. One might marvel not only at his treatment of hidden meanings and his natural philosophy, but also at the plain instruction it gives toward the training of endurance and hardship. For it does not think fit that the man who cares for virtue should live a life of soft luxury and indulgence, emulating the pursuits and ambitions of those called fortunate, but in truth full of misfortune, for whom the whole of life, in the words of the most sacred lawgiver, is a sleep and a dream. Men who, by day, once they have gone through their wrongdoing against others in the courts, the council chambers, the theaters, and everywhere else, come home, wretches that they are, to overturn. Not the house built of stone, but the house natural to the soul, the body, pouring in immoderate and unceasing food and drenching it with much unmixed wine, until reason sinks to the bottom and is gone, and the passions born of the belly's excess rise up, and, seized by uncontrollable frenzy, fall upon and entangle themselves with whatever they happen upon, until, having driven off the worst of their frenzy, they subside. And at night, when the time comes to turn to bed, they prepare costly couches and richly flowered bedding and lie down in the utmost softness, imitating the luxury of women, to whom nature has granted a relaxed way of life, on whose account the artisan who fashions the body has made theirs of the softer material. No one of this kind is an intimate of the sacred word. Rather, those who are truly men, lovers of self-control, good order, and modesty, having laid down self-restraint, contentment with little, and endurance as, so to speak, the foundations of their whole life, safe harbors of the soul in which they will anchor securely and without danger, superior to wealth, pleasure, and reputation, disdainful of food and drink, and of anything beyond the bare necessities. So far as hunger does not begin to rebel, are utterly ready to endure hunger and thirst. Heat and cold and all else hard to bear, for the sake of gaining virtue, zealots for whatever is most easily procured, so that they are never ashamed even of a cheap cloak, but on the contrary reckon costly ones a disgrace and a great loss to life. For these men the lawgiver's ultimate couch is soft ground, their bedding is bushes, grasses, herbs, and a great scattering of leaves, and at their heads are certain stones or small mounds of earth rising a little above the level ground. This life the luxurious call harsh and austere, but those who live for true nobility of character call it most pleasant, for it suits men who are not merely called men, but truly are. Do you not see that even now he introduces the athlete of noble pursuits, though abounding in royal wealth and provisions, sleeping on the ground and using a stone as a pillow, and a little later in his prayers, asking for bread and a garment. The wealth of nature, Gen 28:20. Since he had always mocked the man occupied with empty opinions and derided those who marveled at him. This man is the archetypal model of the ascetic soul, an enemy to everyone who is effeminate and womanish. The ready praise, then, of the man who loves labor and loves virtue has been stated, but the meaning conveyed through the symbol must be investigated. It is fitting to know now that the divine place and the sacred region is full of bodiless words, and these words are immortal souls. Taking one of these words, choosing by merit the highest of them, and setting it, as it were, near the head of his own understanding, as the head of a united body, Gen 28:11, for this too is in a sense the head of the soul. He does this on the pretext of going to sleep, but in truth in order to rest upon the divine word, and to lay upon it the whole of his life as a most light burden. And the word gladly listens and receives the athlete, at first as one who will become a disciple. Then, when he has approved the fitness of his nature, he gives him a hand in the manner of a trainer and calls him to the exercises, and holding him fast compels him to wrestle, until he has built up in him an unconquerable strength, changing his ears by divine inspirations into eyes and calling him, transformed, by the new stamp of Israel, the one who sees. Then he also places on him the crown of victory. The crown has a strange and foreign name, and perhaps not an auspicious one, for it is called by the president of the game's numbness. For it is said, the breadth of the thigh grew numb, Gen 32, 25, the most admirable prize of all rewards, proclamations, and honors. For if the soul, having received a share of unconquerable power and been perfected in the contests of the virtues, and having arrived at the very boundary of the good, should not be lifted up in height by arrogance nor, standing on tiptoe, boast as though able to stride far on sound feet, but should instead grow numb and be checked in the breadth that had widened through self-conceit. And then, voluntarily tripping itself, should limp, so as to fall short of the bodiless natures. Then, seeming to be defeated, it will win the victory. For to yield one's primacy by judgment rather than by necessity is, among the better sort, accounted honorable, since even the second prizes set among the contests of this arena surpass, by a very great margin, in the greatness of their worth, the first prizes set among others. Such, then, is the prelude of the God-sent vision. It is now time to turn to it, and to examine each of its details precisely. He dreamed, it says, and behold, a ladder was fixed on the earth, whose head reached to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it, and the Lord was fixed above it. Gen 28:12-13. A ladder, then, in the world is symbolically called the air, whose base is earth and whose summit is heaven. For from the sphere of the moon, which those who study the heavens record as the last of the circles in heaven and the first with respect to us, the air, stretched out in every direction, reaches down to the very edge of the earth. This is the dwelling of bodiless souls, since it seemed good to the Maker that all the parts of the world should be filled with living creatures. For this reason he furnished the earth with land creatures, the seas and rivers with water creatures, and heaven with the stars. For each of these is said to be not only a living creature, but also a mind, holy and entirely most pure, so that in the remaining portion of the universe, the air, there should likewise be living creatures. But if they are not perceptible by sense, what of it? For the soul too is invisible. And indeed, it is likely that the air nurtures living creatures even more than earth and water, since it is the air that has ensouled the creatures in those elements too. For the craftsman made it the abiding condition of unmoving bodies, and the nature of things moved without conscious impression. And further, the soul of those able to make use of impulse and impression. Is it not absurd, then, that the element through which other things were ensouled should itself be without a share of souls? Therefore let no one deprive the noblest kind of living creatures of the noblest of the regions beneath heaven, the air. For this alone, of all things, is not left desolate, but like a populous city has as its citizens imperishable and immortal souls, equal in number to the stars. Of these souls some descend to be bound to mortal bodies, namely those most drawn toward the earth and fond of the body, while others ascend, being sorted again according to the numbers and periods appointed by nature. Of these, some, longing for the familiar habits of mortal life, run back down again, while others, having condemned its great foolishness, called the body a prison and a tomb, and, fleeing as though from a jail or a grave, are lifted up on light wings toward the upper air and journey through the ages above. But there are others, the purest and best, who have obtained a still greater and more divine portion, who have never at all desired anything of the things upon earth, but are lieutenants of the ruler of all, like the ears and eyes of a great king, watching and hearing everything. These the other philosophers are accustomed to call demons, but the sacred word calls them angels, using a more fitting name, for they announce the Father's commands to his offspring and the offspring's needs to the Father. For this reason he represented them as ascending and descending, not because God, who reaches everywhere, has need of messengers, but because it was advantageous for us, who are subject to peril, to make use of mediating and arbitrating words, on account of our being awestruck and terrified before the supreme ruler and the vastness of his sovereign power. Taking thought of this, we once entreated one of the mediators, saying, "You speak to us, and let not God speak to us, lest we die." Exod. 20:19. For we are unable to bear not only punishments, but even overwhelming and unmixed benefits, such as he himself might bestow directly, without employing other servants. Most beautifully, then, does he represent the air, fixed on the earth, through the symbol of a ladder. For the vapors given off from the earth, being made fine, happen to be turned wholly into air, so that earth is the base and root of air, and heaven is its head. It is said, at any rate, that the moon is not an unmixed condensation of ether, as each of the other stars is, but a blend of ethereal and airy substance. And that the dark patch appearing on it, which some call its face, is nothing other than the air mingled within it, which, being by nature dark, extends all the way to heaven. Such, then, is the latter spoken of symbolically in the world. And if we examine the one within human beings, we shall find it to be the soul, whose base is, as it were, the earthly part, sense perception, and whose head is, as it were, the heavenly part, the purest mind. Up and down through the whole of it, the words of God move without interruption. When ascending, drawing the soul up together with them, and severing it from what is mortal, displaying to it the vision of the things alone worthy to be seen. And when descending, not casting it down, for neither God nor a divine word is ever the cause of harm, but descending together with it out of love for humankind and pity for our race, for the sake of help and alliance, so that, breathing life-giving breath, they may revive the soul still being carried, as if on a river, in the body. In the minds of those who have been utterly purified, the ruler of all things alone walks silently and invisibly, for there is an oracle given to the wise man in which it is said, I will walk among you, and I will be your God. Lev 26:12. But in the minds of those still being washed, who have not yet entirely cleansed away the filthy and defiled life within their heavy bodies, angels, adopted for the task, brighten them with the doctrines of nobility. As for how great a host of evil inhabitants is being expelled, so that the good one alone may come to dwell there, this is clear. Strive, then, O soul, to become a house of God, a holy sanctuary, a most beautiful dwelling place. For perhaps, as the whole world is his house, you too will have as master of the house one who cares for his own dwelling, so that it may forever be preserved most securely fortified and unharmed. Perhaps, too, the ascetic pictures his own life as resembling a ladder. For by nature ascesis is an uneven thing, at one time advancing to a height, at another turning back to the opposite, and at one time faring, like a ship, with a fair voyage of life, at another with a foul one. For the life of ascetics is, as someone said, lived on alternate days, living and awake at one time, dead or asleep at another. And perhaps this too is said not without purpose. The wise are allotted to dwell in the Olympian and heavenly region, having learned always to travel upward, while the wicked dwell in the recesses of Hades, practiced from beginning to end in dying, and accustomed from swaddling clothes to old age to corruption. The practitioners, however, for they occupy the middle ground between the two extremes, often walk up and down as on a ladder, drawn upward by the better portion or dragged back by the worse, until God, the judge of this contest and struggle, awards the prizes to the better rank, utterly abolishing the opposing one. There appears in the dream yet another image, one not fit to be passed over in silence. Human affairs are naturally like a ladder, because of their uneven motion. For one day, as someone said, casts one man down from the heights and lifts another up, since nothing among us is by nature disposed to remain in the same state, but all things undergo every kind of change. Do not rulers constantly arise from private citizens, and private citizens from rulers, the poor from the rich, and from the poor men of great wealth, the honored from the neglected, and the most conspicuous from the obscure, the strong from the weak, and the capable from the incapable, the intelligent from the foolish, and the most sensible from those who were once deranged. There is indeed a road of human affairs that runs up and down, marked by unstable and unsettled turns of fortune, whose unevenness is proved, by no obscure but by quite clear evidence, by time, the most truthful of witnesses. Now the dream signified that the one standing firm upon the ladder was the archangel, the Lord. For one must suppose that being stands above, like a charioteer above a chariot or a helmsman above a ship, over bodies, over souls, over things, over words, over angels, over earth, over air, over heaven, over the powers perceived by sense, over the natures invisible, over everything, visible and invisible alike. For having bound the whole cosmos to himself and suspended it from himself, he drives so vast a nature as a charioteer drives his team. But let no one, on hearing that he stood firm upon it, suppose that anything cooperates with God so as to make him stand securely. Rather let him consider this, that what is meant is equivalent to saying that the support, the prop, the strength, and the stability of all things is the secure God, who stamps immovability upon whatever he wishes. For when he props and supports, the things thus established remain forever indestructible.